Hi everyone, and welcome to 17th episode of Professor P podcast. My name is Parsa Pekar. I'm your host. I'm a psychotherapist, professor, and author. And today we have a very interesting topic, and we want to talk about the influence of language and how the words we speak shape our words. So in the first section of the show, I'm going to go over the book Narrative Means to Therapeutic Ends, which is a book written by Michael White and David Epstein, who were the founders of narrative therapy, which I'm going to talk about that module of therapy as well. Personally, that's one of my favorite module and theories that I apply with my clients as well, and I believe it can be very practical. And then in the second part of the podcast, I'll have Dr. Gergen, who will share his thoughts on the topic. And then lastly, I have one of my students on the show, which will discuss this question. So let's talk about the book. And as we're talking about the book, I'll mention a couple of points about narrative therapy, which the book actually points out. So as I mentioned, this book is written by Michael White and David Epstein, who it was first published in 1990, and is considered a seminal work in the field of narrative therapy, which is a form of psychotherapy that focuses on the stories people tell about their lives and how those stories shape their identities and experiences. I also need to add that not only we tell stories to ourselves, but we always tell a story to other people when we speak. So it's something to always have in mind. So Michael White and David Epstein were both influential psychotherapists from Australia and New Zealand, and they collaborated extensively on developing narrative therapy as an approach to helping individuals and families address a wide range of personal and psychological issues. And the central premise of Narrative Means to Therapeutic Ends is that people construct their identities and make sense of their experiences through the stories they tell. And of course, by stories, we mean the words we speak, right? We create our stories through our words. And White and Epstein argue that the traditional psychotherapy approaches often pathologize individuals by focusing on their problems rather than acknowledging their strengths and resilience. When we have our talk with Dr. Gergen, we're going to talk about how in mental health fields, sometimes we have the same issue, right? Where we put a certain diagnosis on the client and that becomes a big stigma. So in contrast, narrative therapy seeks to empower individuals by helping them reauthor their stories in ways that highlight their agency, values, and preferred identities. And therapists using this approach engage clients in conversation that explore alternative narratives, challenge dominant or oppressive stories, and co-create new meanings and possibilities. I love that. So through the book, White and Epstein provide numerous case examples and practical techniques for implementing narrative therapy in clinical practice, and they also emphasize the importance of collaboration, curiosity, and cultural sensitivity in working with clients from diverse backgrounds. And overall, this book had a significant impact on the field of psychotherapy, which inspired countless in therapists to adopt a narrative approach in their work with clients. And it continues to be widely read and studied by mental health professionals who seek to understand the power of storytelling in healing and transformation. I also recommend to people who are interested in psychology to study this book. It will give such a great examples, case examples, as I mentioned earlier, and make you understand better this theory. But of course, I would like to provide some top lessons from this book. So first is understanding the power of stories. The book emphasizes the significance of narrative in shaping individuals' identities, experience, and interactions with the world. And as therapists, we learn to recognize the stories clients tell about their lives and the influence these narratives have on their well-being. I think it's very important if we have certain stories we tell ourselves to first identify what those stories are, right? Become aware, have an awareness and conscious to see, okay, what stories do I tell myself? Stories are the things that are going on, the self-talk that we have every day with ourselves. So ask yourself that question, become aware, develop a sense of awareness of how those stories affect you and how they're shaped. The second point is externalizing problems. So White and Epson introduced a concept of externalizing problems, which involves separating the person from the problem. So, for example, if you want to externalize issues like depression, anxiety, or addiction, therapists can help clients view their problems as a separate identities that can be explored and addressed more effectively. I would also add, as I say, therapist, but you can also think of it as an individual. So, the example I always give is there is a difference that we say I'm a failure and I failed. One is your identity, right? You already attach the failure to your identity. You say, I am failure. Where on the other hand, when you say I failed, it's an experience. And with narrative therapy, we even go one step further. We don't even use failure. We might want to say, I've tried something and it did not work, right? The word itself, trying, has a positive tone to it, right? Rather than failing. The third point is reauthoring narratives. So therapists are encouraged to collaborate with clients in reauthoring their life stories, and this process involves exploring alternative narratives, challenging dominant or oppressive stories, and co-creating new meanings and possibilities that align with clients' values and preferred identities. I would highlight the word meaning. So if we want to change our stories, I think the first and the most important step is to find a new meaning and purpose for our life that we want to base our story on, right? So that's very important to have in mind. The fourth is to cultural sensitivity, which the authors stress the importance of cultural sensitivity in narrative therapy. And as therapists, we are urged to consider clients' cultural backgrounds, beliefs, and values when exploring their stories and co-creating alternative narratives. And cultural competence is essential for building trust and rapport with client and ensuring therapy is respectful and effective. I would like to also add that this point can also be applied when we are having a regular conversation with a person who's from another culture, right? As therapists, something that I've learned to do, and it's very related to this point, is if I have a client who's from another culture, I make sure I study some things about their country in order for me to understand them better, right? This can be also applied in our relationship and the way we relate to others. Fifth is to deconstruct dominant discourses. So White and Epson advocate for deconstructing dominant discourses that may contribute to clients' distress, and therapists can help clients question societal norms, expectation, and stereotypes that influence their self-perception and behavior, which in result empower them to challenge and resist oppressive narrative. The sixth is appreciating strengths and resilience. So narrative therapy focuses on uncovering clients' strengths, resources, and resilience. So it's a very positive way of looking at therapy, right? As you could tell. And as therapists, we can highlight instances of agency, courage, and perseverance in client stories, reinforcing their capacity to overcome challenges and enact positive change in their lives. And as therapists, we work alongside clients as partners in this process, right? Which we value their expertise and perspective. And we promote autonomy, self-determination, and empowerment. So overall, I would say this book offers such a valuable insights and practical techniques, not only for therapists who seek to integrate narrative approaches into their practice, but as I mentioned, also to individuals, right, who are looking for something, if especially if you're stuck in your life, right? If something is not working, I would encourage you to apply narrative therapy. And as I mentioned, the first step is always to have an awareness. So try to understand the stories you tell yourself and question them. Are they true? Because our story is usually, we've been telling ourselves those stories for a very long time, right? And sometimes the first step is to question if they're really true, if they benefit us, and how they make us feel, right? Because every thought we have, every belief we have, it affects us, even the words we speak, right? As I've been saying, try to see if we can use, instead of any negative words, find an alternative and train your brain to think that way. So, for example, instead of saying this is hard, say this is challenging. Already you've made a change in your brain. When you say this is challenging, you get it might get excited. It's a challenge. But when you say hard, you're already thinking that this would not be possible. So put those words aside, you know, hard, failure, etc., and try to find alternative and create a new story. So now let's look at some practical steps in order for us to apply narrative therapy into our lives. So the first step is to identify dominant narratives. So we want to reflect on the dominant narratives that influence our self-perception and behavior. And these narratives may include societal norms, cultural expectations, right? Our family dynamics, or personal beliefs about ourselves and our capabilities that we have developed since our childhood. So it's very important, again, to have the self-awareness of how those dominant stories are affecting us and identify them. Second is to externalize problems. So practice externalizing your problems by separating them from your identity. Instead of defining yourself by your challenges or struggles, recognize them as separate entities that you are facing. For example, instead of saying I'm anxious, we can say I'm experiencing anxiety. So you see, you're already separating the problem from yourself. Third is to reauthor your story, which means you take an active role in reauthoring your life story by exploring alternative narratives that align with your values, strengths, and aspirations. And you want to focus on moments of resilience, growth, and empowerment in your life and envision new possibilities for yourself. There are three key points to remember when you are reauthoring your story. Make sure it aligns with your values. That's very important. I would even, before I write my story again, I would first define my values. Second is to identify your strengths. So what are them? You know, you can tell your strengths when something feels natural to you. And lastly is your aspirations. What is it that you're truly passionate about? That can be your aspirations. So you want to base your story on those three points. The fourth step is to challenge oppressive narratives. So you want to challenge or limit narratives that contribute to feeling of, you know, being shameful, having guilt, and question the validity of these narratives and explore alternative perspectives that empower you to reclaim agency and autonomy in your life. Again, identify them and then question if they're true. And if they're useful and beneficial to you, that's another thing. So you want to challenge those narratives. Fifth is to cultivate self-compassion. So you want to make sure you practice self-compassion by treating yourself with kindness, understanding, and acceptance. And you want to acknowledge your inherent worth and value as a person and be gentle with yourself as you navigate challenges and setbacks. So let me tell you this, when you first identify and then challenge those oppressive narratives, and you write a new story. Many times you go back to the same story that you have, right? You realize that in your mind, you are telling the old story. And that's okay. That's actually the way it is. It's a process because imagine You have lived with those stories for such a long time, and now you want to change them. So, of course, it will take time. And that's when you want to make sure you practice self-compassion. And I would encourage you to do something else. When you do see something positive, like let's say you have this new story that you're telling yourself and you act on it and you see even as small as changing your behavior, what I would encourage you to do is to reward yourself. Do something positive for yourself. So in that way, your brain gets training that this is a good thing to do and it keeps wanting to do the same thing, right? So that's very important. Six, you want to utilize narrative techniques such as, journaling, storytelling, or creative expression to explore your experiences and gain new insights. And you want to write about significant events in your life and reflect on your emotions and reactions and identify recurring themes and patterns. Seventh, you want to focus on strength and resources. As you're focusing on your strength, resources, and resilience, you navigate challenges and you are able to pursue your goals. So you want to take a positive approach toward your story, right? And you want to celebrate, as I mentioned, your achievements, however small they are, and recognize the progress you have made along your journey. The eighth one is to seek support and connection. So you want to reach out to supportive friends, family members, or mentors who can provide encouragement, guidance, and perspective. And you want to share your experiences and reflection with others and listen to their stories in return. If you think about this, that every person has a story to tell, I guarantee you that people become much more interesting to you because you realize there is a story that everyone has. So you want to learn and be curious about them. And I also emphasize this point very much that having the support group, people who truly care for you, are so important in your process because they can keep you accountable, they can question you, and they can guide you in your path. And lastly, is to practice ongoing reflection and growth, which means you engage in regular reflection and introspection to gain clarity about your values, goals, and aspiration. And you set aside a time for self-care, self-reflection, and personal growth. And you're open to learning and evolving as you continue to navigate your life's journey. I do believe when we apply these practical steps, we can harness the principles of narrative therapy in order to gain a deeper understanding of ourselves and overcoming obstacles and create a more empowering narrative about their lives where we feel happy, blessed, and peaceful with the story we tell ourselves and other people. Please stay in tune. We're going to be back and hear from Dr. Gergen on his perspective. Dr. Gergen, welcome to our show.
Thanks so much, Parson.
Of course, thank you for being here. So, Dr. Gergen, what is one value that's important to you and why?
Oh, do I have to just pick one?
Sure, you can be more than one.
And it depends on the day. This may sound strange, but if I were to pick one that is particularly important in terms of what I do, and that is human coordination, our capacities to coordinate with each other
Right.
in a way which is nourishing. Well,
Yeah.
although I can say a lot about that because partly I view coordination as the root of everything we do. The root of language, root of all that we care about, but also the ways in which we're split and break down those coordinations. So it's just terribly important that we're capacities to basically to understand each other, to move together, to co-create the future, which as I say, is nourishing to to all.
Yeah, that's actually a great start because we want to talk about the topic of the influence of language.
Yes.
So let me get into it, Dr. Gergen. How would you say language affects the coordination in as a whole?
Well, it goes both ways. Look at language as a byproduct of coordination. That is, all the words that I use aren't words until you agree they're words. So there are, every word that we say has required some, at least two or more people to agree that, yes, that utterance is a word, and this is the way we're going to use it.
Yeah.
Okay? So out of that process, that co-coordinated process, comes language. But once we fix that, and once we know how to use it and what our projects are for using it, then it reduces the range of what we can do for good or evil. As if you're performing an operation, you better know what the suture is, and everybody ought to understand that it. We all work together. We're all going to call that a suture. And when I say suture, please, you're going to give me that.
Yeah.
But now you get down to the culture in which there are numerous ways of coordinating with different groups, different in the culture, having different ways of calling things. It's okay, and you're a medical unit, and everybody knows the same how to play the game, you might say. We all know we perfectly well coordinated around that surgery unit. But if you're perfectly coordinated around two different political parties, now you got another, and both those parties can claim that what they're doing is for freedom. What they're both doing is claiming that we are here for the betterment of the country.
Yeah.
Now you've got some different issues on the table.
Yeah, that's true. So what you're saying.
I'll give you another example because it's very close to psychology. And that's a diagnosis of psychiatric problems, the DSM, as it were, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. Now, we have people who about do strange things. We are probably both included. But maybe we just don't do them in public, or maybe we can't help doing them. So we're in quote weird in some way. We don't fit quite. There's nothing about not quite fitting or being weird that makes you mentally ill. That is, that's just a way of talking. That's just a label. It comes out of psychiatry, out of clinical psychology. That's just that group of people who will say, okay, this is a we diagnose you into this category, and we'll do treatment based on that. This will be our treatment. These will be our, let's say, our pharmacology we'll use, and this is the number of times we'll do it, or whatever. And that seems fine. Most people are quite okay with that, but it when you start taking apart these ways that the language works, you begin to realize that, again, they are circumscribing our capacities to for flexibility. And once you start calling people who are unusual, mentally ill, you place them into a regimen that is controlled by a certain group of people who do have a certain idea of what good is. Good example, for example, is attention deficit disorder. Now, when I came through graduate school, it didn't exist. Some people were active, some people were more active than others. Some didn't pay attention, some paid attention. But it wasn't a disorder. It was just, hey, pay more attention, or you're going to flunk out if you do that. Or, I mean, we just treated it as part of the one of the variations of growing up. Now you've got one in 10 or more, even of students who will be evaluated attention deficit disorder. Now, why? Why? They're not ill. There was nothing wrong with them until you told them that was wrong. I mean, they're just hanging out doing their thing. Now you're saying you have a problem because you're not paying attention to me. So you have a problem as a teacher. You need them to score well. Their parents have a problem because their kid isn't doing well. The kid himself got no problem until whammo, are not paying attention enough to make good grades, and so we will find a category for you, and now you will be on Ritalin or some other drug until it makes you better. Now, Ritalin doesn't cure anything. It's really basically it helps you to attend, but it's not curing any disease. And most kids I know in college who have Ritalin, they sell it to their classmates for exam time. You can't tell when the disease is finished because there's no measure of when it started. And now we spend almost $1 billion on drugs. That drug, and it doesn't exist outside of the language that a certain group has and applies it. Parents like it, teachers like it, drug companies like it, and therapists thrive.
Yeah.
And the kid is just caught up in this machinery and a language and a tradition which just. That's where it becomes critical to look at those languages and what they imply, who's using them, and for what purpose. Because they're going to create a reality that you may well find yourself in the middle of. In fact, you do.
Yeah, that's
I'll
interesting.
give you, let me give you a couple of other examples. By the way, in Ireland, traditionally, if somebody were a little strange, they would say, "Oh, he's with God. He's just with God. You know, maybe he's walking around the street talking nonsense, but he wasn't mentally ill. He's just having a talk with God. That's all right." And we had somebody in our neighborhood when I was young, and he never grew up. He was a little strange. He'd come around and play with the kids and. Everybody knew who he was in the neighborhood. Anyway, let me just stop there for a second.
Yeah, Dr. Kagan, I have a question. Well, first of all, as a therapist myself, I'm not a big fan of giving people a diagnosis because I do believe when you give diagnosis to people, it becomes like a box that they put themselves
Yeah,
into.
exactly.
Yeah, and becomes this identity, right? So now I have
Yeah.
this, therefore this is who I am, right? So that's
No.
pretty much can get into that sense. I think something I want to ask you, which I was thinking as you were mentioning about the ADHD, and you hear that so much nowadays, especially, oh, I have ADHD, and
Yeah,
people say
exactly.
it, yeah, very lightly.
Or
Do you,
I'm on the spectrum.
yeah, or
That's
that's,
why I
yeah,
can't do this.
that is true. Do you believe, Dr. Gergen, most, like, I know, maybe I do believe people have that, you know, diagnosis for the right reasons, but we are talking about those who don't. Do you think the fact that they say that and they believe that about themselves make them actually have those symptoms too, if that makes sense? So the language they use to identify with themselves, say, oh, like I have ADHD, right? So the language and the belief that comes with that language makes them to actually have those symptoms of someone who actually has the diagnosis.
I think both things. I mean, people are different that way. But for some, it's a crutch, a social crutch, because it allows me to say I can get out of things, or I'm excused because I can't do that, or I can treat you like hell. And but I just can't do help myself. And as you're putting it, it could almost invite you into using it because it is such a useful crutch. Depression. I'm depressed. People take care of you.
Yeah.
So it becomes useful. And I'm without even thinking about it, not saying I'm going to adopt this just to manipulate people. I don't think it's like that. I think it just becomes easy to do it. So you just go into that process because you're going to get nice gestures towards you. I'm so depressed today. Oh, tell me about your problem. I'm sorry. What can I do for you? Can I help you? Can I love you in some way? Who wouldn't stay depressed?
Yeah, and I think sometimes you can get into that victim mindset that, okay, this is who I am and I'm gonna deal with it, right? Like, this is who I am, who I will be. Therefore, as you said,
Well,
there is an excuse for my actions.
it is the case with a lot of language use that it segments or puts you in a place. I mean, like nouns for a person, place, or thing, which means there's a you, but it doesn't take you as you move, because we're always moving, but the language tends to poop. Like if you're depressed, well, but even depressed people, what it's more like a mood. I mean, we can all be depressed from time to time, but you're not depressed every minute. That's like the whole day you're just sitting there depressed, probably not. Or anxious, you're not anxious every minute, and certainly attention deficit, you are paying attention a lot of the day. Give you your cell phone and you will be really paying a lot of attention.
Right.
It boxes you in. Now, it's almost like a way of looking at the world of a world of atoms or things, which is a long history of atomism going back to Earth, from Western culture, early Greece, where you had a philosophy of the world made up of particles, basically, of things, which you could name and which were stable. And process philosophy, which is all is in motion, never caught on. If you look at things in motion, continuously in motion, people is continuously in motion, you almost don't have a language to say you are, because you aren't the next moment the same person. I mean, even your name was a little bit, I guess you have to use it from situation to situation. It's more like how would you label an ocean wave?
Yeah.
Know it. So it goes back to a whole way of understanding, which comes out of our language, which we can put everything in a box and manipulate it, predict it, and control it.
Yeah. This is very interesting, Dr. Gergen. What comes to my mind, this is something I've practiced over the years in my own life. Because I've seen, for example, I try to use the words in my language when I speak to myself or other people.
Oh, yeah. What is
And
Farsi?
Farsi is my native language, but I'm
Yeah.
just saying in general. For example, if I want to say something is hard, I say challenging. Like, I say to myself, I say, because I see how when I say hard, like I say, well, this is hard. When I tell myself or tell someone, automatically my body has a reaction and I feel it, right? Like, and my mind kind of blocks it. Oh, this is impossible. But when I use challenging, it actually motivates me and makes me even want to do it because it's like a fun way to look at that. So instead of
Yeah,
hard, I say challenging.
absolutely. Yeah. So
Yeah.
a lot depends on the day and what word you use to take on things, whether you're angry or I'm just upset. Big difference. Anger is like, I'm gonna, upset. Well, it can be, it doesn't mean you have to necessarily have an object that has made you angry. All sorts of things like that. Yeah, I have this experience yesterday of getting a cortisone shot. Now, I know they're really painful. I've never had one until yesterday, and they are painful. So who am I going to be? Am I going to call that a challenge? Or am I going to say, oh my God, I'm going to really be in pain? And what I did actually, I said, I'm going to treat it as more like funny. As you're watching a comedian getting hit in the head with a pie. I'm going to treat it more like that. And I tried to laugh, sitting there like, ha! I don't know if it hurt less, but it certainly was a different experience by trying to, how I name it means a whole lot.
Exactly. That's the thing I was trying to get to. I think the way we name things really affect the way we look at it at the situation, but also the reaction we're gonna have toward it and the attitude.
Another case that's really major significance is the whole gender spectrum, where young people begin to break down the whole gender spectrum, so you almost can't say it. I mean, it is so complex that you almost give up what is gender as a chromosome. Genitals, a way of being, a way of thinking. It's all those things because the different groups will use that term in a different way. And the term is almost losing its capacity to make any meaningful distinction. Same with sexual interest. That's become now fluid. Like, well, I don't know. I don't have a special person I'm looking for. It's just whatever I'm attracted to. We shouldn't break things down into these categories. Now, that's the whole youth culture is just moving, breaking all those categories down to the great chagrin of their parents and the rest of the right wing. But it's really interesting to watch that because that's a phenomenon in youth culture, which has been facilitated largely by digital communication. They can communicate with anybody and have connections and begin to make these reasons and rationales for themselves, and adults don't control it anymore.
The way I look at it, also Dr. Gergen, that language also can bring order, right? Like in this case, it sounds
Oh,
very,
yes.
right? So how can we use our language to bring order? Because when we are talking about those topics, for example, it can be confusing at times, right? To say, oh, this or that.
Yeah.
So how can we use language in a way to bring order into our life? Because what comes also to my mind, I'm sure you know, there is this form of therapy called narrative therapy, which is basically
Yeah.
talks about how our life is like a
Yeah.
story, that we use our language to form it and make meaning, out of it. And actually, Dr. Gergen, in one of my classes, I teach this theory called career construction, which talks about how your career is like a life story that you create through your story of your life, right?
Yeah.
But part of what that theory talks about is you bring meaning from the language you use to your life and order. So I
Yeah.
wonder, how can we, in the world we live today, it sounds there are a lot of chaos and confusion, right? That is happening. So how can we bring that, order and meaning with the language we use,
Yeah. Let me just preface that by going back to narrative therapy a minute because it relates to something we were earlier talking about, and then I'll go on to. I've been involved with narrative therapy for many, many years because when social construction was getting underway, narratives were one of the big key players, and narrative therapy was an actual practice that was emerging with this whole constructionist movement. But the problem, one of the problems that I've had with it, and I'm not sure we want to work it out here, but at least it'll relate back to what we were talking about. If I restory my life, I wasn't a loser. I sustained myself. I sustained myself through all of this, or whatever. I've promised, and it's here, and I can do this, X, Y, and Z. That's my new story. How can one live in one story? I mean, if we're continuously changing, do we want the box of one story? How useful is that? And then I began to think, well, maybe it's we should move towards the ability to generate stories, not to have one, but the same way we were talking about, okay, I use challenge. Now that's a skill. And so what are the skills that we have that could go from day to day? One of them might be, okay, I've survived. That's one story and it's useful, but it's not like who I am. It's like one of my capacities to understand myself. Anyway, that's one of the arguments I've been trying to make in a narrative context. Now, back to the question of order. I think there's we almost, I don't want to say naturally, but language largely is used to generate order. But if we're trying to understand each other, we are doing it through the coordination of language. Oh, you're going to call that a good performance? Well, I'm not sure it's a good performance, but I can now see what you say, and now we know it's a good performance. Blah blah blah. We're constantly creating order because to live in chaos is extremely difficult. Problem is that the multiplicities of orders, that's where I don't think there's a problem with ordering in itself. Problem is when there are multiples and there are different orders. So what you look at as really good behavior is for me awful. And you not only have that, but the capacity, because of largely through the internet, we can have multiple orderings. We can co-create new religions. We can co-create new ideas about reality. And finally, have 50 people with us, and we all agree, yes, blah, blah, blah. That's the real issue. And I guess it goes back to what I was saying about coordination. And this, I am. This is a deep problem for me. How I've just had finished a long conversation on how we could get away from voting as our way of deciding things, because the very practice of voting makes us drives us into an order, which we reinforce and support in antagonism to another order. So once you put political parties in and the winning and losing is by votes, there's no understanding there. There's just anger and criticism and distance, alienation, and all the rest of the stuff that we're living through now. How else could we have that conversation? And I've just been talking about how you could set up AI so that you could get multiple opinions and people wouldn't have to choose. They would just be informed of all the various ways you could look at this thing and then talk over. Anyway, I won't go into it all, but that is one of the major problems facing the world today, is that multiplicities of orderings. And how then to generate the language which allows us to move beyond that. And if you look at education, generally it will teach you there's a good order and a bad order. And it will teach you to have a position and to defend that position yourself, because you're a singular person. You ought to have a rationale and know what you believe in, and blah, blah, blah. But you aren't taught very much about how to get along with people who disagree with you, or how to generate a group opinion that we all can stand by when there are different opinions. Collaborative education. Mean, why not, instead of rating everybody on whether they're good or bad on having their opinion right, have it collaborative? And maybe there aren't any necessary rights and wrongs or positions. Some good for this and that. But learn how to coordinate in ways that don't drive you to saying, this is it. Not moving here because that's the only reality. So yeah, dialogue is what I'm into. And dialogue and governance, how you can do it. Dialogue in schools, how you can promote that. All in the service of how are we going to get along together? Not just your perfection, my perfection, but when we differ in many, many ways.
So, Dr. Gergen, I was actually, it's interesting because I was thinking to ask you that. How can we use our language to create that? Like, is there things that we can practice as individual and even as a group that we say, okay, language can create that positive result.
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples if you want, but I don't want to take up too much time on this. But there are therapists now, largely come out of family therapy, but who have ways of bringing people together on who are in diverse positions, like pro-life, pro-choice, which are really, really divided, and saying, "Hey, come, let's talk together." And what they do is they set up the conversation. So they say, first of all, tell a story about how you got into this position. And they listen to each other about why they feel that way. And usually they're stories of being, let's say, of rape, or a child couldn't have an abortion when they've been such and such, or there's some story there which is sympathetic, usually. And just listening to those stories, you already begin to get a sea change. Just not that you agree, but they're not enemies. And they'll say something about what value do you place on that? What are the values that you see here? And when you state the values in abstract, like women should have the freedom of their bodies or the value of human life, usually on the abstract, they can agree. Yeah, I think that's a good value. I'm not opposed to women's having freedom. I'm not opposed to, I don't, I'm not for, everybody should have abortions all the time. Nobody's for abortion particularly, but. And then they ask me things about what are their doubts? Okay. Then you most people, if you push them, they've got doubts about it. Or what do you see as valuable in the other's position? They control the dialogue. Not with the aim of you're going to change your mind, but you're going to change the way you are with the other. It's going to be a more muted or more, I'd say, more coordinated form of activity. Oh, there was one of these groups out of which they decided they worked together to provide more information on birth control, which they could quite agree on. That was a good idea. So there are therapists who work on that problem. There's one now called Braver Angels. It's a national program to bring red and blue communities together. And the techniques of talking are coming out of family therapy. How do you get husband and wife who hate each other into some other, And they have ways of doing that, but you plan the conversation. You just don't say, "Hey, let's get together and talk," because people be killing each other. That we all know how to destroy each other. We all know how to disagree.
Yeah, so part of it, I believe, is about just listening in order to understand,
But you
not.
have to listen to a certain kind of thing, not why you're so awful and why you have destroyed my life.
And I can relate to this so much, Dr. Gergen, because as a therapist, right, I have different like clients with different beliefs, right? Which they might agree with what I believe or not, but I've learned for me to be there for them completely, I have to set aside my own beliefs and just listen to them and help to the best I can and meet them where they are. And that does create this close relationship, I think, between people that we start to understand, okay, this is how we can. Even if we don't agree with that person across us, we can still respect and, have dialogue, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I've been very interested in that issue because at what point ethically would you? Because as you're right, everything you say, it, being with them is really important. But at what point, what if they're going to places you just cannot tolerate? That's just against something very deep in you. How then do you reply? What then can you do? I mean, I think there are choices to be made. One can do that. What would you think about, or have you considered such and such a position, or can you see doubts that you might have in that given next word? But we live in sort of complex moralities, and it's nice to get into people's moralities, which are different, but at some point you have one too, and it represents part of society. So it shouldn't just be shucked away just for make sure they feel okay about wanting to poison their husband. Can get
Yeah.
that. I see why you want to do that.
It can be challenging, Dr. Gary. And as you mentioned, there are times where they say something which, of course, you're so against it. But of course, in therapy, we have a term counter transference where that's your own thoughts. You try to project, but you try. I think the best is to be able. I mean, I'm talking about a therapist. Of course, it's different in our relationship too, right? Like in our intimate relationship, I think because our feelings are involved, maybe it's not as easy, right? Where we might get into this reaction mode that we answer right away. But I think if we truly want to listen to someone, we have to have this thought in our mind that we want to listen to understand, not to make a point. So, and that can help. And I think in therapies, it does help a lot as a therapist.
No, I think that's the number one issue you're pointing to be with them on that journey, because it's often frightening and nobody, they don't know what to do, and that's why they're there.
Exactly.
It's you get into that and don't. And then it's a question of, to me, and I've seen so many therapists go in different directions about. Then what will change be? Because if you continue to listen, will it just deepen the story of what they're saying? And different therapists have different ideas. We could talk about that too all evening.
Sure. I think I would just want to add something and then we can get over. I think something I always tell my clients out there, Gergen, which is helpful. I always say therapy is like going to this room that is dark, right? And you put a light on different part of it, right? And I think therapists basically have that the work to just show to them, by having questions to make them more aware of themselves, right? So if they're going down the path and it's not right, I think if you are first provide the environment that is accepting for them to share that with you in the first place, and then kind of ask question to kind of challenge their beliefs about that. Of course, if it's a wrong belief or whatever, then you can put that light, right, where they might not be even aware and it's darkness, right, in their mind or their thoughts. So that's the way kind of I look at it when it comes to that. And
Sounds like scaffolding to
yeah,
me.
because Dr. Gergen, some especially those who haven't had experience with therapy, I think many times they treat their therapists as like medical doctors. They expect you to give them like a receipt, like recipe. Oh, here's what you do in 5 days, you're gonna be good, and take this, and you're done. But of course, therapy is very different because it's a process, and our mind is very complex.
Yeah.
So,
We actually had a therapist at Swarthmore who was fired because he wouldn't put people in diagnostic categories and give them any anxiety, any depression. He wanted to talk with them. And they just that was the last resort. But for many therapists, it's the first thing you do.
No, for me it's last two, so I need to be
Yeah.
with my job. Yeah, I do believe diagnosis can be misused a lot, and it's been misused, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It has to be very, I think you have to really take into consideration in order to do that, because at the end, you want the best for your client, right? And putting them in diagnosis right away, I mean, that's not, I think, ethical.
Yeah, and usually every physical I have, they'll ask me if something's been bothering me and I'm feeling okay. And if I said I was anxious, I am sure within 5 minutes I would get any anxiety. I could have a
Yeah.
prescription.
Unfortunately, amongst the psychiatrists, that can be very common.
Yeah.
Where, I had clients who come say, yeah, like I just met with him 5 minutes and they just prescribed me like medication, and it's
Yeah.
not the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Regan, this has been such a great conversation with you. I've been really enjoying this.
It's been fun. Thank you a whole
Of
lot, Parker. It's been
course.
great fun.
If you could suggest one act of kindness, what would that be, Dr. Jürgen?
You mean in the whole world, an act of kindness? Does it have to be the only act? Could it just be one?
Share anything.
I would like, I mean, because I feel it's limit myself. I would like to be go out of my way to help someone who was on the other side of the political spectrum. I would help me a lot to, I think, to loosen up a little bit and not be quite so cantankerous. I mean, right now I feel a little hardened politically, and that's not good. I feel like I'm becoming an extremist on the liberal side, and maybe that's not a good thing to do. I need to have more flexibility. So, to be kind, to try to generate another kind of way of being together, that would be, for me, a really good thing to do.
I think for especially in the times we live in, I think that's so
Oh,
important.
yeah. Well, you know it from yesterday, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Gergen, thank you for being here.
Okay. All right. I said good luck to you. It's been a joy.
Thank you. Okay, I have Shirley, one of my students here. Shirley, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me today, Professor.
Of course, Shirley, can you give us a little background about yourself and one value that's important to you?
My name is Shirley, and I am in my second year at Pepperdine doing the clinical psychology program. And before this, I graduated from UC Irvine with a bachelor's in criminal justice.
Interesting.
And
Go ahead, Shirley.
sorry, and one of my values, I think, is serenity.
Interesting. Is there a reason you like that value in the specific?
I think I grew up in a household where there was a lot of chaos growing up, and so for me, peace is a really valuable thing for me, and serenity, I think that's something that I really appreciate, just being in a calm space.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. So Shirley, today we're talking about the influence of language and how our language affects us, shape our lives, or even, the relationship we have with other people, how it affects them. What is your view on that?
Yeah, I think we're always communicating. Like, even when we think we're not communicating, our body, our face, our language is always saying something. And so, even if it's not words, the way that we move, the way that we carry ourselves, is saying something to people at all times. And so I think it's important to take into consideration the words that we use, the way that we express ourselves, because these are things that do carry a lot of weight. And I think that's something that a lot of us fail to recognize sometimes, is that words that might not be hurtful to us can come off as hurtful to others. And so it's really important to consider language, the words that are used, the tone that's used. Like, there's so many different factors when it comes to communicating in general.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think what I'm curious to know is, as a therapist, how do you think the way you speak to your clients affect them? We were talking with Dr. Gergen about how certain mental health diagnoses can have such a big effect on people. Like you tell them, oh, you have depression or etc. It's a language we use, but sometimes, of course, there is a meaning behind that. That makes people think certain way. So how does that affect, your relationship with your clients in your work practice? And of course, I think also you mentioned about you studied legal, and I think that's where you work too, right,
Yeah,
Shirley?
that's also
Where,
where I work.
from our class, yeah. I mean, I think language in the law field is so important. What you say, where you say it, how you say it, right? So what is your take on that?
Yeah, I agree. Language is really important. And I think when it comes to clients, especially with diagnosing, it is really important to be considerate of like where the client is at and take into consideration if the diagnosis might be more hurtful to them or if it can be helpful. I think in something like telling them that they have depression or something, it could help in that they find ways to cope and to deal with the depression. But if it's something more significant, like say a personality disorder, for example, that's when you really have to exercise caution and like, will it affect the client more than it'll help them? And I think that's where rapport comes in. So I think every therapist has like their own style of being with clients. And I know that for me, I definitely try to take on a more kind of like a casual approach. Like, I'm still a therapist in the room, but I'm also not there to give advice or to be a stern person in the room. And so just kind of meeting the client where they're at and taking their stage into consideration when telling them a diagnosis is important.
Do you have an example where you said something, Shelly, to your clients and you realize, wow, that really affected them in such a positive way?
Yeah, I can't think of a specific example right off the top of my head, but I know that there have been times when a client is going through something particular. I think a lot of my clients have depressive episodes, and it really helps when you validate them that they're not alone in that experience. experience. I think that's the biggest general example that I can think of, that a lot of people feel alone in their experiences. By simply validating and offering support and letting them know that they're not alone, that really does make a big impact. And it makes them feel that they're not in this struggle alone, that there are other people experiencing the same things. And so I think just having compassion and expressing that what they're going through, a lot of people also experience is helpful.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think validation plays a big part in communication and making people feel they're heard and seen. And
Yeah.
certainly a tool that we use, of course, as therapists too.
Yeah, it is really important. I know you mentioned like my work in the law firm, and so even there it's really important. I think over there we also work with clients that have dealt with a lot of abuse and assault growing up. And so these are people that have never spoken about this to anyone. And when you're talking to them on the phone, they are breaking down, they are crying. And for some people, it's really just this is the first time where they're actually heard. And so just coming from a place of like being a human, just a human listening to another human who's had really difficult experiences and just having compassion and empathy. And I think that's those are the big things in communication with others.
Right. I'm just curious, Shelley, for yourself, do you see a way of connecting those two together? You know, your experience in law and, of course, being a therapist.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot, I think that there's a lot of things that can lead people to kind of become involved in the legal realm. So I think if we think of childhood experiences, there's always people that might be more resilient because of different factors and might be able to come out of on the other side of things okay. And then there's people that might go down a different route and become involved with the legal system. And that doesn't mean anything different about them. That just means that they need more support. And so I think that's where it ties in. I think psychology plays a big role in the legal system as well. If we understand, like, even big, I guess, serial killers, even for example, like at the bottom of their actions, there's been a lot of trauma, a lot of childhood experiences. And I think that's where it ties in that our childhood really influences who we are as adults. And if you can just help someone tackle that experience, then they might become a better person at the end of it.
Right. Great example. Great, Shirley. So first of all, thank you for being here. And for our last question, if you could suggest one act of kindness, what would that be?
Think one act of kindness that is really valuable to me is just being kind to animals and other beings that we often don't think of as being so much. Even if it just means like stopping on the road because a squirrel is crossing the street, just something minor like that, and being mindful of the other beings that we share the world with.
Great. Shirley, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Professor. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in, and I look forward to be with you in the next episode. And meanwhile, if you want to stay connected, you can reach me via email at contact@parsapaykar.com.